he asked. Where's Tew? Doran offered a pained smile. She's in Thrakken Salsolo's mansion. Captured? No, Tahiri said. Hiding.
Hiding?
We ran into a trap, Doran said. It sounds like you did too. Lots of guards, several combat probots, a couple of YVH droids. Not a tenable situation, so we decided to run away. Tahiri gave him a reproving look.
There was nothing we could accomplish there, so I ordered a nice, clean withdrawal, which would have been fine if Brilliant Notions here hadn't had his great idea.
Now Jaina fixed Doran with a hard stare.
Which was what?
Doran shrugged. We ran into this deactivated protocol droid in the room from which we decided to stage our retreat, and it occurred to me. I could dress it in my clothes. Tahiri and Tew could carry it out, and it would look like they were taking the body of a fallen comrade to safety. They knew three of us had gone in. They'd watch three of us escape. And I'd hide there, see what I could find out in the wake of this disaster.
And a naked man the size of a dwarf Wookiee is going to stay hidden for how long? Jaina demanded.
Doran winced. That's what Tew asked, in almost those exact words, as a matter of fact. Jaina didn't want any member of her operation left behind on Corellia. But she had to admit that a resource hiding out in Thrakken Salsolo's opulent home could prove invaluable in the days to come.
Corellian Orbit.
Sayal and her temporary wingmate, a male Mon Cal flying Vibrosword 10, shot out one side of the ever-broadening starfighter combat zone and began a loop around to re-enter from another angle. Things were getting uglier. More squadrons from both sides had joined the furball, accumulating halfway between the two vessel formations. Now other gunships, larger than starfighters but smaller than vessels of the line, were turning in to join the combat.
Dodona to Vibrosword Squadron. Return to Dodona. Upon arrival, do not stand down. Be ready for immediate relaunch.
Coronet Corellia.
Luke roared in toward Mara's X-Wing, which closed toward him, their combined speed causing the numbers of the snub fighter's range meter to scroll too fast to read. As they reached the point where Luke could almost see his wife's face, a point at which most pilots would be unable to react in time to save themselves, Mara died, flashing mere meters beneath Luke's X-Wing, and revealing the attack fighter tailing her. The attack fighter's pilot tried to vector out of Luke's way. He succeeded. He didn't succeed in dodging Luke's lasers. Red flashes converged on the cockpit, and suddenly the fighter was a cloud of smoke and shrapnel. Luke flew through it, pieces of attack fighter fuselage bouncing off his deflectors and scraping off his hull. He emerged into blue sky on the other side. On his sensor board, he saw Mara looping around to return to his wingmate position. The latest detachment of attack fighters was down to two viable starfighters, and now, realizing the depletion of their numbers, they suddenly veered off, leaving the dogfight. Nine Jedi X-Wings, increasingly battered but all still in fighting condition, remained.
Leader, this is Three.
Go ahead, Three. Luke checked his diagnostic board.
The landing party has reported in. They have a shuttle and are ready to launch. They're expecting heavy pursuit once they climb above the no-fly altitude.
Luke brought up a map of Coronet. It showed his squadron's location, and courtesy of Hardpoint 3, a blip indicating the location of Jaina's crew. Luke tapped the screen to designate a point much closer to the landing party's position than his own. R2, designate that point as location link-up. 3, tell the landing party to make their way to link-up without attracting pursuit. We'll join them there and everyone will take off for space from that point.
Center Point Station.
No, you're not!
Ben told the ungangly assembly of droid components.
Anakin Solo's dead. He died when I was little.
The couplings where the droid's torso units met its arm attachments lifted noisily, a gesture that looked like a human shrug.
Yes, I did die, and I became a ghost, and I was eventually drawn here to inhabit this mutated clone body, where I could help my ancestors, the Corellians.
That's not a clone body,
Ben protested.
It's a droid body.
The head swiveled so the droid could look down at itself.
You're wrong, little cousin. You're here to sabotage this station, aren't you? To destroy it, so the Corellians can never enjoy freedom and independence.
Boy, have they got you programmed.
Ben took a step forward, his lightsaber up in ready position.
Ben convulsed and his vision blurred. He felt his entire body twitch and heard his lightsaber hit the floor and roll away, humming for a moment before its safety circuit switched the power off. He shook his head and his vision began to clear. He was a meter off the floor, the air around him shimmering. His legs still twitched. The droid shrugged again.
I'm sorry about that. It's an anti-Jedi defensive feature installed by my other cousin, Thrakken Sal Solo. It constantly monitors brainwave activity in an area. When centers of the brain that tend to become active when force powers are being utilized are detected, it turns on. Repulsors under the floor hold the Jedi safely above the ground, and electrical emissions, mostly painless, interfere with the Jedi's concentration. See? You've stopped using force powers, and it has stopped shocking you. Efficient, isn't it?
Yeah, sure, whatever.
Ben reached down to draw his lightsaber back up to his hand and jerked and jolted again as the defensive system electrocuted him a second time. After a few seconds of recovery, he said, I guess it really works.
It does, doesn't it? So, what were you going to do here?
Destroy the station? Or at least disable whatever they're using to regain control of the repulsor weapon.
Ben looked dubiously at the droid.
I guess that's you.
Pounding began on the other side of the door. Ben winced. The guards outside would be calling for reinforcements, and even as badly as he'd damaged the door, it would still be only a few minutes before they had it open. He'd failed. Well, not quite yet.
They tell you they're going to use the station's weapon to stay independent,
Ben said.
And that would be fine if that's what it was all about. But it's not. They're lying to you. The first big lie is that you're Anakin Solo and that you're in a living body. You're not. You're a droid.
The droid sighed.
Yes, yes, of course.
It's true. They needed Anakin Solo's biometric data to control the repulsor weapon, so they probably got his fingerprints from old records. They would have reconstructed his brainwaves from whatever medical recordings they could find. Probably had to adjust them and mess with them until they could affect the station controls. And they installed them all in you, so they'd have an Anakin Solo who'd think and behave like a human, but do whatever they say.
I'm Anakin Solo. I'm a Jedi. I have control over the Force. See?
The droid extended an arm, and Ben's lightsaber flew from where it had rolled into its hand.
That's not the Force. I would have felt it if it was the Force.
Ben considered.
Since you can't have repulsor lift vents installed everywhere in the room, it was probably directed magnetics. You grabbed the metal handle of the lightsaber with magnetics.
He tried to keep an expression of dismay and sadness from his face. He didn't think he was very successful. It wasn't just that his mission was in jeopardy. There was something grotesque about this situation, about dealing with a droid that honestly thought it was his cousin. He'd have to find some way to destroy it.
There are security holocams operating in here, aren't there?
Ben asked.
Sure.
What do you look like in them?
I am a very big human teenager with somewhat overdeveloped bones to handle the strain caused by my great mass.
I'm going to open my pouch. I'm going to pull out a little holocam. Please, let me record you with it.
Go ahead.
Ben reached into his pouch and pulled out a holocam unit. Ben brought the holocam up, made sure that the droid's magnetics had not disrupted its operation, and began recording.
Do me a favor, he said. Wave, like you're on holiday. Do you have a message for your parents? Say something.
That's a good idea.
The droid waved awkwardly.
Hey, Mom. Hey, Dad. I'm working hard, but having a good time. I hope I'll get to see you soon.
Ben stopped the recording and held out the holocam.
Now look at what you just recorded.
The holocam flicked out of his fingers and into the droid's hand. The droid lifted it to his mouth slot and internalized it. Ben waited.
It's a lie,
the droid finally said. The droid turned its upper body as it looked at Ben again. The boy could swear that its posture sagged. Tears sprang to Ben's eyes. He wiped them away.
I'm so sorry, he said. But it's true. You're a droid who's been programmed to think it's Anakin Solo. But if you were really Anakin, you'd help me destroy the station now. Because the people who made you can use it as a weapon, and they could destroy whole stars with it.
How would you have destroyed me?
I didn't come here to destroy you. I came here to destroy the station. I have a way to cause this control room to send a pulse through the station and wreck it.
Killing everybody aboard?
No. It sends an emergency evacuation code first and waits 10 minutes.
Give me the data.
Ben reached into his pouch and grabbed the spike-top data card. As an afterthought, he also grabbed the other data cards, those that would have initiated self-destruct or shutdown sequences from other control rooms in the station. He held them up and felt the droid's magnetics yank them out of his hand. A moment later, they went into the droid's mouth slot.
Analyzing,
the droid said in its heartbroken tones. Then,
oh, I know where that interface is, but I've been interpreting it as a candy dispenser.
That's wrong, Ben said.
I have to reinterpret myself in light of what it really is. These commands... No, I won't take life unnecessarily.
Unnecessarily? Think about what's going to happen if you don't.
It's true. Somebody is going to die. Them or me. Me or them.
The droid resumed its earlier posture.
Analyzing programming,
it said, its voice distracted, almost droid-like.
Security bypasses. Passcodes. Hey, there's some brilliant stuff here.
Our best spies have been working on it,
Ben said absently. The clanking and voices from the hall were becoming louder.
Time's kind of running out, Ben said. What are you going to do, Anakin?
I'm not really Anakin, am I?
You're an Anakin, not Anakin Solo.
Anakin Sal Solo.
The droid laughed, but it was a humorless noise.
Thrakken's offspring. That's what I am.
Ben suddenly found himself falling. He landed in a crouch on the floor. He looked cautiously up at the droid.
I'm not going to destroy this station. I guess that means I have to die.
I'm sorry,
Ben said, and he truly was.
There it is, right at the human builder interface. The code representing the station's imprinting on Anakin Solo. I'm installing a procedure to scramble what the station thinks Anakin Solo is, and another one to purge my memory in me, in all my backups. Without those files, I doubt they'll ever be able to deconstruct what I've done. There's my own code, my programming. Checks and locks in place. Let's get rid of that one.
It sighed, a sound of tremendous relief.
There we go. No more fear of death. Take 3 steps to your right.
It took Ben a moment to realize the droid was addressing him. He obeyed. The lightsaber flew from the droid's hand to him. He caught it out of the air.
Straight down from where you are, there's an unguarded chamber. It leads to a corridor that parallels the one outside. You should leave now.
Jason caught up to Thrakken in a corridor intersection. Against the long wall, flush with the floor, there were 2 shiny silver discs, more than a meter in diameter. Above them, transparent tubes emerged from the ceiling a short distance, no more than 20 centimeters. The tubes looked like some sort of escape access, but no ladders led up to them. Thrakken was in the act of reaching toward a control panel on the wall when Jason lashed out through the force, hammering Thrakken into the wall. The older man bounced off, rolling painfully to his knees atop one of the silver discs. And then Jason reached him, holding the glowing tip of his lightsaber just under Thrakken's chin. Jason saw the tips of Thrakken's beard hairs blacken from the heat. A distant wail filled the air, a keening noise seemingly emanating from all directions at once, echoing and overlapping, as though a city-sized droid were suddenly grieving for a slain offspring. Thrakken paled. Jason grinned. That's the evacuation alarm. It means we have 10 minutes to get off this station before it destroys itself. Which means that my apprentice, who is fortunate enough not to share any blood with you, has succeeded in setting up the station's destruction. He leaned closer. I can still share in his success a little bit. I could kill you. Remove your stain from the galaxy. Thrakken shook his head.
Jedi don't kill prisoners who have surrendered.
You haven't surrendered.
I surrender.
Thrakken raised his hands.
There.
Perhaps Jedi don't, but I might. You've done nothing but do damage to Corellia, to the New Republic, and to my family since I was a child. Wouldn't the universe be a better place without you in it?
Very funny, Thrakken said.
Jason could feel the tiniest trace of increased distress in the man's emotions. Distress, and no, he was feeling something else, from somewhere else. Pain, death, from the future, from a future, one of any number of possible futures. Jason peered into it, letting the events of that potential timeline wash over him, but kept one eye on his cousin, alert, through just his sight for any treachery. Events flashed past him too fast to absorb all their meaning.
Starfighters launched lasers and missiles, raining death on the innocent. Why not the guilty? He could see no guilty. Pilot versus pilot, soldier versus soldier, no one was guilty. Neither side was more evil, more dark. War spread out from Corellia like ripples from a rock hitting the surface of a pond, and the rock was an image of Jason and Thraken. Jason saw clouds of expanding gas where the Brave had flown, corpse-littered fields where the Brave had fought, near unrecognizable ruins that had once been huge space vessels, but were now crushed like beverage containers on the rocky surfaces of moons. And pain, pain racking the Force like nothing had since the Yuuzhan Vong War. Pain twisting his kin. Shrieks of loss filled his ears. He focused on the rock in the pond, the image of himself and Thraken, and saw all these events unfolding from the point, the here and now, when he failed to kill Thraken.
Shaken, he yanked himself back from the vision and stood there, breathing heavily.
"What is it, boy?" Thraken asked,
his tone almost kindly.
"You've gone pale."
Jason blinked at him. He got his voice under control. "I apologize. I actually do have to kill you now."
"You're insane. I've surrendered."
"That's not enough. You ruin the future, Thraken. For the greater good, our Jedi traditions notwithstanding, I have to kill you."
"But my droids are here."
A blaster opened up from behind Jason. He turned to intercept the bolt, and partway into his maneuver, cursed himself for being tricked. No one stood in the hallway. The sound of blaster fire emerged from a small circular device, adhering to the ceiling, near a glow rod light fixture. Jason continued his maneuver into a full spin. His lightsaber, ending its 360-degree sweep, would cut Thraken in half. Instead, it hit a gleaming metal column. Jason glanced up. The column was rising out of the floor, propelling the metal disc Thraken stood on up to the ceiling. The disc hit the edges of the transparent tube, and Thraken's feet launched up from the disc and disappeared from sight.
Coronet Corellia.
"On the datapad, it's CCC-39,
Doran shouted forward from the passenger compartment. In the co-pilot's seat, Zek twisted uncomfortably and shouted back,
"I'm telling you, the signs read Wedge Antilles Boulevard."
"Be quiet,"
Jaina snapped from the pilot's seat.
"It's got to be the same route. Cities rename their streets all the time."
Their vehicle, a standard Lambda-class shuttle, its wings locked in the down position for flight, cruised down the center of the Coronet Boulevard. Zek twisted his face forward again.
"This seat is too small for me."
"It's too small for anyone," Jaina said. "I think it's built for a child."
A groundspeeder rose from a lower lane and settled into place in front of the shuttle's bow, close enough that its proximity alarm sounded. Precisely what the irritated Corellian pilot ahead intended. Jaina growled.
"Rudest pilots in the universe," she said. "Where's Uncle Luke?"
"Soon, soon,"
Van soothed from the main compartment. A new sound cut through the shuttle's hull. The warbling alarm of a Corsec groundspeeder. Sighing, Jaina checked her sensor board and found the view showing the vehicle. It was right behind the shuttle, its flashers going, its pilot waving her to descend. They reached a point where Wedge Antilles Boulevard crossed under an even broader avenue, listed as Five Brothers Avenue on both the datapad and the ground-level glow signs. As Jaina's stolen shuttle neared the intersection, she and Zek recognized some of the traffic up on the Five Brothers overpass, a formation of X-Wings tucked neatly among the ground speeders, and also pursued by a Corsec speeder, doubtless piloted by a very annoyed officer. She keyed her communications board.
"Hardpoint, this is Perella Tauntaun. We have you on visuals. Over."
Luke Skywalker's voice crackled back instantly.
"Are you spaceworthy? Wait, I see you. Begin your ascent. Out."
"Belt in or hang on," Jaina shouted.
The shuttle leapt into the sky.
Corellian space.
The ships of Admiral Kloskin's task force pulled away from Corellia's gravitational attraction. It would be some time, long minutes, before they were far enough away from the gravity well to make a jump to hyperspace. The vessels of the Corellian fleet moved in, forming up in small groups of four and five ships.
"But they're not moving in for the kill," Fiav Fenn said. "They've recalled their fighter squadrons."
We're just going to get harassment fire, then, Kloskin said.
Probably.
How's their frigate?
Floating dead in space.
The forward elements of Kloskin's task force, including Dodonna, reached the leading edge of the reconfiguring Corellian fleet. Dodonna began shivering as she sustained long-distance laser battery fire. But as Kloskin had predicted, nothing heavier hit her. Nothing threatened to batter down her shields. Harassment fire. The Admiral grinned.
In about half an hour, they'll wish they tried to blow us out of the sky.
Yes, sir.
Fenn's voice sounded dull. Kloskin wondered what had happened to diminish her enthusiasm for her job. As they passed through the harassment screen, Dodonna shook and vibrated, but Kloskin never felt genuinely threatened. Reports continued to flood into the bridge. GA ship after ship reached the point where they could enter hyperspace. Preliminary starfighter losses from the skirmish were assessed. The last lagging vessel in Kloskin's task force reported readiness to enter hyperspace.
All ships jump, Kloskin ordered.
A moment later, the stars through the forward viewport seemed to twist and spin in unsettling kaleidoscope visual image. An instant later, they straightened themselves, and the white-clouded blue and green planet, Tralis, wrenched into view in the distance ahead.
All starfighter squadrons, Kloskin said. Launch!
2 hours later, it was done. A world was occupied and subjugated. To be sure, this wasn't a tremendous military accomplishment. Tralis was lightly occupied, and its defense against invasion amounted to a few scattered Corsec units, plus a dangerous, well-armed commando unit holding the installation built around the repulsor unit, associated with Centerpoint Station. Kloskin's forces didn't bother with the repulsor defenders. They merely swept down on the city of Reladir, whose population of 1 million made it a metropolis by the standards of Tralis, and took the city and planetary leaders into custody. Units of Kloskin's task force landed in the city and occupied several downtown blocks. A few assault shuttles full of elite soldiers surrounded the repulsor facility with orders to keep its garrison bottled up. The rest of the task force ships remained in orbit, a defensive perimeter.
I need a brief rest. I'll be in my quarters.
Kloskin turned away from the bow viewports that had occupied its attention for the last several hours and began the long walk to his quarters. Minutes later, the door into his quarters slid open and he strode through. Only then did his pace change, his step fading from energetic to slow and weary. He sat on his bed, remained upright long enough to pull his boots off, and lay back. The air above him shimmered, and Adila appeared. She was a trifle overweight, but dressed well to compensate for it, today wearing a green formal gown with a low neckline. In all the years they'd been married, she'd never looked more radiant. At the moment, she looked far happier and healthier than the month before she died.
I'm glad you came.
Shh. She put a finger to her lips, then lowered it to his.
You need to rest. You did so very well today.
I did, didn't I?
Yes. Don't ever let anyone ever tell you that you didn't.
Her tone was almost stern.
You just wait. Soon enough, they'll all be saying how you took impossible orders and sliced a victory out of them. You'll be famous. You'll be promoted to Fleet Admiral.
Yes, dear.
No other reward would be acceptable. Anything else would be an insult.
Yes, dear.
Sleep, Matrick.
He did.
Coruscant.
2 days later, Luke Skywalker, dressed in the full robe array of a Jedi Master, was escorted to a conference chamber within the densest government precincts on Coruscant. Several invitees to the meeting were already there and seated. At the head of the table was Chief of State, Cal Omis, a lean, fair man with thinning hair. He wore garments cut in the fashion of a formal GA military uniform, but in non-regulation deep purple. To his right sat Admiral Galad Pellion, acting chief of the GA military. Despite his advancing age, Pellion still appeared formidable, thick-chested, his white hair still bushy, his mustache still ferocious. To his right sat Admiral Nyathol, a female Mon Calamari. Unlike Akbar, perhaps the best-known military Mon Cal officer in recent history, she was known for an icy disposition and cutting reprimands.
Her outsized eyes followed Luke as he entered the chamber. He spared her a glance and a slight friendly nod. He did not know her well, and had neither affection nor disdain for her. Elsewhere at the table sat advisors and aides for the three. Chief Omis gestured to the unoccupied seat to his left, and Luke took it.
"Good to see you, Master Skywalker. Thank you for arriving so quickly."
"Happy to oblige, sir."
"So,"
Omis glanced at Pelion,
"Admiral, would you care to begin?"
"Yes."
Pelion glanced at the datapad before him.
"Master Skywalker, how would you describe the Jedi operations that were part of Roundabout?"
"Successful," Luke said, "but not cleanly so. We had 5 operations, Slash Rat, Perella, Tauntaun, Womp Rat, and Minock. Slash Rat, commanded by Master Corn Horn, was a 2-operative team, observing Coronet's main starport for significant starfighter launch activities. Since most of Coronet's starfighter squadrons had apparently been pulled for Corellia's fleet action, of course, Slash Rat's usefulness was largely nullified. Perella and Tauntaun, respectively commanded by Jaina Solo and Tahiri Vela, were assigned the task of kidnapping Prime Minister Adel Saxon and Chief of State Thrakken Sal Solo from their residences. Their mission was an almost complete failure due to what appears to be foreknowledge on Corellia's part. Saxon and Sal Solo remain on Corellia. Womp Rat, which I commanded, had the task of retrieving Tauntaun and Perella, and was successful, though not without loss. We lost a shuttle and its 2-person crew, and an X-Wing with its Jedi pilot. Finally, Luke said, there's Minock, the most important of the operations, and the one for which the other operations, as significant as they might have been, were also to act as a diversion. Minock was, from both a short-term and long-term perspective, spectacularly successful. Centerporn Station was removed as a threat through the elimination of the control mechanisms the Corellians had designed to make it completely operational. But the station itself wasn't destroyed, meaning that in the long run, it can be further examined and investigated. There was some loss of life among the Corellian Security Force members defending the installation, but neither of the Jedi involved in the mission was hurt. And this all despite the fact that the Corellians in charge of the station were fully aware that operatives were coming, that Jedi operatives were coming. Niathal asked,
"Could General Wedge Antilles have been the conduit for all the advanced knowledge the Corellians received?"
Luke frowned, puzzled. "I don't think so. Wedge is retired. I doubt he was involved at all, on either side."
"Oh, he was involved," Niathal said. "As an extension of the same governing principle that led to Operations Tauntaun and Perella, he was picked up and transported here prior to Operation Roundabout's commencement to keep him out of trouble."
Luke covered his eyes with his hand.
"He escaped a short time later and apparently returned to Corellia,"
Niathal continued.
"It's just been announced that Chief Sal Solo has ousted the old Minister of War to assume the position himself, and Antilles has been assigned liaison between Sal Solo and Prime Minister Saxon."
"I'm surprised," Luke said. "Surprised that he'd taken a position like that."
"I'm not,"
Pelion said.
"If I'd been subjected to that sort of treatment, I might declare a personal war on the government that had authorized it. I suspect Antilles isn't fighting for Corellia. He's against us. Us personally."
He indicated himself and Kyle Omos, then turned to Niathal.
"Find out the name of every officer who botched any portion of the operation against Antilles. Perhaps he'll remove himself from the picture if we bust every one of them down to floor sweeper."
"Admiral, it will be a pleasure."
Niathal turned to Luke.
"I need you to be logical instead of sentimental when answering this. Could your sister have been the leak, informing the Corellians about the Jedi involvement?"
Luke shook his head. "Impossible." Niathal made a wet, rubbery noise, the Mon Calamari equivalent of a snort of derision.
"Nothing is impossible, Skywalker."
"Enough," Chief Omis said. "It's out of the question."
"But there is a leak somewhere," Luke conceded. "In the Order, here in the seat of government, I'm not sure which. We have to find it and close it."
"Another question," Pelion said. "What impression do you have of Admiral Kloskin?"
Luke considered. "Mostly favorable, at least as the operation was coming together. He seemed smart and decisive. When things started to go wrong, though, well, it seems obvious that he chose badly. Improvisation does not appear to be one of his skills."
That's putting it mildly, Omis said. But really, that's all you or any of your Jedi could say about him?
Well, no. Luke suppressed a sigh. Reluctance to speak ill of someone was out of place here. Except for me, Jedi dealings with him were very limited. I saw him at several briefings. All the team heads except Corn Horn, Jaina, Tahiri, Jason, and I were at one briefing, but all the Jedi met him at one dinner. It was after that dinner that one of my Jedi, Chiu Zax, a recently confirmed Jedi Knight, said that she'd had the oddest impression from him. Nyathol asked,
"Which was what?"
That he'd blanked out at one point during dinner. That while I was swapping starfighter pilot stories with Jaina, Kloskin had just gone away, mentally. An absence so strong she felt it through the Force, just for a few moments. Nyathol's eyes edged forward, a gesture perhaps meant to intimidate.
"And you didn't report this?"
"Report what?" Luke shrugged. "The same sort of thing can happen when someone enters a meditative state, or falls into a particularly private memory. Do you believe it could be evidence of a more significant problem?"
"Oh, yes,"
Nyathol nodded.
"He has apparently experienced a complete emotional and mental breakdown. 12 standard hours after the occupation of Tralis, his aide, Colonel Fenn, found him wandering Dodona's corridors in his robe, looking for his wife, his dead wife. He hasn't responded much to questions or orders since. Dodona's officers have been told that he collapsed from exhaustion."
"Which brings us to the last subject of significance we need you for, Master Skywalker."
Chief Omis rubbed his chin.
"The occupation of Tralis and its consequences, Operation Roundabout, was supposed to force the Corellians to realize they can't just rebuild their giant blaster in space. We were to take the giant blaster away and wrap their heads with our knuckles. We failed to wrap their heads. The arrival of the Corellian fleet prevented that. But we did take their giant blaster away, and had our task force returned to Coruscant from that point, we still would have been ahead, if only slightly ahead, in the game."
"But the occupation of Tralis,"
Nyathol said,
"has made them angry. Fighting mad, I believe the expression is."
"Corellia continues to arm herself," Pelion said. "Other planets are expressing outrage about the way Roundabout was conducted. Kaminor, Fondor, Bespin, coalitions within the corporate sector, more every hour. Some of them simply playing political games, of course, but others could conceivably join Corellia in a military alliance."
"I know." Luke's voice was rueful. "Maybe those other planets would ease off if we showed them the evidence you've gathered about Corellia's secret assault fleet."
"We can't," Omos said. "Our evidence isn't incontrovertible, and some of those worlds would ally with Corellia even if it were. We'd be tipping our hand for nothing."
"And we still wouldn't know the location of the fleet," Pelion said.
"But we can still manage this through diplomacy. Prime Minister Saxon has indicated that she would be willing to meet with us in a mission of peace, even travel from Corellia for the meeting. But not here, not to Coruscant."
"Where then?" Luke asked.
"Not yet determined," Pelion said. "That's not important. It will have to be a system that both sides consider neutral on this issue. Now, Chief of State Omos cannot represent the Galactic Alliance, since his rank is substantially higher than Saxon's. For the leader of hundreds of worlds to travel to meet the leader of 5 would be too great a sign of weakness."
"Of course," Luke said.
"So he'll be me," Pelion continued. "Each side will have a security detail in place, but Prime Minister Saxon has made an interesting concession. She's willing to stipulate the neutrality of Jedi on this issue, and to have as many Jedi present as you, Luke Skywalker, wish, to defend the diplomatic mission."
Co-opt system, Toyaz Station.
5 days later, an odd collection of ships converged on a space station in the Kuat star system. The station itself was of unusual design. At its core was a disk 2 kilometers across, 300 meters thick, its edges beveled and smoothed like an ancient polished cred coin, its surface thick with glowing viewports in every imaginable color, blue predominating. From the edge of the disk, at regularly spaced intervals, radiated a dozen narrow spokes 1/4 kilometer in length. At the end of each spoke was a pod 1/4 kilometer across, 40 meters high at its thickest point.
Six of the pods were disks, resembling the central core, and six were triangular, affixed to the spokes on one point of the triangle. Tor Yaz Station was a place of recreation and competition, negotiation and romance, cold-blooded calculation and hot-blooded rage. Its core disk was an environment of hotels and shops, gardens and waterfalls. By dictate of the trade families that ran the station, hotels did not offer single-room accommodations. The lowliest quarters available for rent were lavish suites whose daily rent was equivalent to the yearly earnings of a middle-class family. The 12 pods were somewhat less glamorous, at least on initial inspection. Each would have been a fully self-contained space station but for the spoke, a sturdy broad traffic conduit connecting it to the main station. And in fact, in times of crisis, any of the pods could separate from the station's main body, thrust free through use of a slow but serviceable drive unit, and maintain itself in space for days or weeks until rescue arrived. Each pod, which included hundreds of sets of quarters, conference chambers, exercise and recreation facilities, theaters, kitchens, vehicle hangars, security chambers, cell blocks for rowdy celebrants, and vast atria, could be rented as a single unit for any sort of corporate event. And now one of them, a triangular pod known as Narsak Habitat, had been hired by the government of the Galactic Alliance. The Narsak Habitat's crew of stewards, cooks, waitstaff, cleaning and maintenance droids, valets, and dressing consultants had been dismissed on full pay for the duration of the GA stay, replaced by carefully screened government employees. The only Tor Yaz Station employees left were a skeleton crew of security officers, amply reinforced and overseen by GA security specialists. The first ships to dock with Narsak Habitat, one large transport each from Coruscant and Corellia, discharged hordes of soldiers and security personnel who immediately began scouring the pod for listening devices, booby traps, and hidden weapons. After 2 days of examination, both sides reported to their respective leaders that there was no sign of ill intent from their opposite number. Sufficiently reassured that matters could progress, both sides brought in protocol droids and status engineers who examined the habitat's facilities, comparing them with the events of the conference to come, and immediately began negotiating to make sure that their respective sides would have slightly better than equal habitat resources. This went on for another full day. The next day, the remaining ships dedicated to the diplomatic mission drew in to land in hangars spaced around the perimeter of Narsak Habitat. One hangar was larger than all the others, but neither set of status engineers could agree on the envoy from either side arriving there. It would be too great a slight to the diplomats' perceived status, so it went unused. The Galactic Alliance and Corellian envoys landed in hangars of identical size, while the Jedi put in at a hangar slightly smaller than the others. Then the three groups met in the habitat's largest conference area, roomy enough for two games of zone ball to be played simultaneously. One set of tables had been arranged as a conference area, its seating carefully ordered by the rank of the individual assigned to it. Another set had food laid out upon it, a buffet of dishes from several worlds, including Coruscant and Corellia. A third area was bare of furniture, but a phalanx of musician droids was arrayed against one wall. The area's purpose, as a floor for dancing, was obvious. Han Solo, technically a consultant with the Jedi Party, strode in beside his wife and took a quick look around the broad area.
"This isn't a negotiation meeting."
Leia smiled up at him. "No, it isn't."
"It's a party," she nodded. "Why are we wasting time with a party when we've got two sides about to go to war?"
Luke, walking two steps ahead beside his wife, grinned over his shoulder at his brother-in-law. "Nobody's going to war while the delegates are here. The only one with any likelihood of wanting to is Thrakken Sal Solo, because war will give him a better chance to assume control of the entire Corellian system, and our intelligence contacts say he doesn't yet have enough influence over the other four Corellian chiefs of state to manage that. And this gathering projects the idea that things are calm," Leia added.
Han grimaced. "I need my blaster."
Jason, right behind his father, with Ben in tow, said,
"You feel defenseless without it, Dad?"
"Nothing of the sort. I just want to shoot everyone who decides on these protocols."
Jason nodded agreeably. "If I ruled the universe, I'd let you do that, as a service to galactic civilization." Luke's smile lasted for another two steps. Then he straightened, looking forward.
He stepped to the side of the Jedi formation to let it pass and began looking right and left. Mara, Han, and Leia stepped out with him, letting the others continue on. Jason, Ben, Jaina, and Zek moved toward the center of the room, Ben sparing his father a curious glance. Mara asked, "What is it?"
"He was here," Luke said.
"The man who doesn't exist." Mara began a slow, casual, visual sweep of the room and asked,
"How long ago?"
"I'm not sure," Luke admitted. "I just had a flash of him in the Force, but it was clear and distinct. And again, no dream." The party, Luke had to admit, did serve its main purpose, giving the news gatherers information that would probably reassure the public at large, and a secondary purpose, that of an icebreaker. At its start, the attendees stood about in rigid little groups, dictated by their function and place of origin. Here, Corellian politicians, backs to a functionally identical group of Coruscant politicians a meter away. There, a cluster of Jedi. At various points around the wall stood pairs and trios of security operatives, here GA, there Corsec, next Toriaz station experts. Oddly, it was a pair of aging pilots who began to thaw the hard edges of the groups. Walking together, Wedge Antilles and Tycho Selchu moved from cluster to cluster, shaking hands, clapping backs, telling stories. Their genuine affection for the people they were addressing was obvious, as was their genuine unconcern for the political boundaries of the gathering. Tycho was first on the dance floor with Prime Minister Saxon. Wedge, with Leia, was next. Soon, the noise level in the chamber rose, and the boundaries between groups increasingly blurred. 4 hours after it began, the party ended. A handful of delegates and advisors moved to a much smaller adjoining chamber set up with a long conference table. Prime Minister Adel Saxon sat at one end, Admiral Gilad Pellion at the other, and their respective parties occupied the seats between them.
"So," Pellion said, "rules of order?"
"Let's dispense with them," Saxon said.
She looked weary but not ill-tempered.
"Let's get to it," Pellion said. "Prime Minister, may I call you Adel?"
"Please."
"Gilad, I'll stipulate that the arrival of a GA naval task force in the Krellian system was an unfriendly act, if you'd be so kind as to make the same admission about the secret reactivation of Centerpoint Station. Let's get that out of the way. Let's neither of us pretend that one side or the other is blameless."
Saxon smiled in mock sweetness.
"We can still argue over which is the greater offense."
Pellion nodded.
"We can. Which is to your advantage?"
Saxon looked surprised.
"You admit that?"
"Of course. I'm a very old man. Any protracted argument, well, I could die at any moment."
The old strategist smiled to put the lie to his words. Saxon, caught out, smiled despite herself.
"All right, let's prioritize then. I won't pretend that the only possible outcome of this gathering is Corellian independence. Corellia has at times thrived as part of a wider government. She has also thrived as an independent state. But she can't thrive as a disarmed state dependent on GA forces for protection of the system. Corellian pride won't allow for that. Insist on that, impose it, and you transform us into something other than Corellians."
She pointed in turn to Han and Wedge.
"Think how things would be in the GA today if not for Corellians like these. There would be no Galactic Alliance, no New Republic. It would still be the Empire."
Pellion smiled again, this time showing teeth. The obvious reply would have been, "And what's wrong with that?" Instead, he said,
"So what you're arguing for, principally, is the preservation of a Corellian space navy above and beyond the Corellian Defense Force?"
"Of course."
"That's not necessarily impossible," the Admiral said. "But would Corellia still be able to provide resources to the GA military at a rate dictated by its gross system production, as other GA signatories do? That would seem to be a substantial drain on Corellia's economy."
"Well, obviously our contribution to the GA military would have to be reduced by a value equivalent to our space navy, and that navy would be available to the GA for military activities when called upon."
"Not acceptable. The Galactic Alliance military funding has to come first."
This first meeting between Pellion and Saxon went on for 4 hours. Eventually, the two diplomats agreed to retire for the evening and resume their talks in the morning, station time. The delegates and their advisors discovered that they were all quartered on a single passageway of Narsak habitat, where the rooms commanded the best view of stars and the moon Rhone. The passageway was named the Calabarth Way. At each end of its 275-meter run, and at any point a cross-corridor intersected it, a security station had been installed. The Galactic Alliance delegation was assigned the spinward end of the passageway, having won the right to the slightly more desirable quarters by virtue of the GA having paid for this conference. The Corellian delegation was quartered at the far end. The Jedi accommodations were in the middle. Still awake a couple of hours after the breakup of the first meeting, Han sat on a couch facing the Solo Suite's largest viewport, a huge expanse of radiation-shielded transparasteel, 15 meters long and 5 high. At the moment, it was oriented out to space, but the starfield was slightly marred by the presence of the GA frigate Firethorn, guaranteeing safety only a kilometer out.
"I think we have the exact center suite," Han commented. "Accident or design?"
"Design," Leia said. She was sitting in a chair 2 paces closer to the viewport than Han's couch. Han turned his attention to Jason, seated at the other end of the couch.
"So," his son looked thoughtful, "I don't like this stuff about a man who doesn't exist."
"Neither do I," Han said. "Neither does your mother."
"Maybe, but I suspect we don't like it for different reasons." Jason gave Leia an apologetic look. "Ever since Uncle Luke started talking about it, I've been looking, sensing, peering into the future and the past to the extent I can." Leia nodded. "And?" "And nothing. I don't see or feel any trace of something like that." He frowned. "There's the faintest touch of a female presence that feels antagonistic, malevolent. It has some flavor of the Force with it, but it's so faint it doesn't have to pertain to the here and now. It could be a leftover from years or decades ago. It could be pre-imperial. Could it be a Force user who's here now and using arts to diminish her presence?" Leia asked.
Jason nodded.
"Maybe."
2 levels above Calabarth Way and toward the Habitat Center, in an auxiliary security command compartment normally occupied only in times of emergency, Captain Siren Tawaller scanned a series of readout boards, looking for trouble. Tawaller felt rather than heard his companion lean over his shoulder, and was for once not startled when she spoke. Her voice was, as ever, quiet and silky.
"I am always amazed at the initiative security officers show in ensuring that they can peer through every set of holocam lenses on a ship, pry into every confidential computer file, and access every ship's function, even when they're not supposed to."
A comment like that would normally have made Tawaller feel defensive, but here it seemed soothing. Tawaller chanced a glance over his shoulder. The woman who stood there was a beauty, tall, slender, and aristocratic, her dark eyes intelligent. She wore colorful but cumbersome robes in the latest Kuwati style, and she did so with a grace that began with a lack of self-consciousness. Tawaller shrugged, trying to appear unconcerned.
"A security officer has to be able to provide security, even when commanding officers are killed or subverted. He has to be able to see where everyone is, know what everyone is thinking. Otherwise, things aren't safe."
"You're right, of course."
There was amusement in the woman's tone. And again Tawaller was surprised that he wasn't even a little offended. The woman's words sounded like condescension, but of course they weren't. Of course they weren't. This woman had come to him with the news that he, Captain Siron Tawaller, was under consideration to be the Telbun of a lady, to be the consort chosen to father her child in the ancient tradition of the great ruling merchant houses of Kuwat. His intelligence, his personal strength, his determination had brought him to her attention, and somehow she had looked past the indifferent service reports that had been written about him, had dismissed the petty jealousy and backstabbing competition that had led superior officer after superior officer to label him as unmotivated and adequate. His personal and financial success, and those of his family, were now assured, despite the curiously low regard with which people of other worlds viewed the role of Telbon. But first, he had to pass a test of loyalty. He had to help this grand lady preserve her house by eliminating the rogue Jedi assigned to kill her. Why Jedi would want to kill a Kuat mercantile princess was beyond Tawaller. But that was all right. His specialty was point security, not anticipatory security. His eyes were drawn to a constantly updated readout on the first information screen. 4 minutes until dock, he said.
Good. Let's go meet them.
There were 20 of them, all human, men and a few women uniformed in gleaming black body armor. The chest plates were rigid carapaces, the helmets narrower than pilots' protective gear. Upper arms, legs, and hands were protected by a mesh-like material, heavy but flexible. Lower arms and legs were encased in the same heavy material as torsos. They carried gleaming black rifles, of types unfamiliar to Tawaller. 3 different designs, all of them curiously oversized, one of them intended, as the placement of the padding and sights indicated, for shoulder mount use. And their faces. Tawaller didn't know what to make of their faces. Slightly obscured as they were behind the amber faceplates of the helmets, they seemed just a little wrong. The analytical portion of his brain went to work on the problem, even as the men and women began streaming in through the airlock. Age range, 30 to 60, he estimated. Older than ordinary recruits. Averaging older even than a standard unit of elites. Planets of origin. It was never easy to calculate such a thing, but a certain characteristic leanness of features and the way they made eye contact suggested Corellia. Yet in other ways, their mannerisms were strikingly non-Corellian. Tawaller saw none of the good cheer and cockiness that usually characterized the soldiers and citizens of that system. And there was something wrong with them, a hollowness to their cheeks, an odd intensity to their expressions. "They're dying," the woman whispered the words in Tawaller's ear as if answering his unspoken question. "Each of them, from various wasting diseases that medicine can't arrest. They're all still at something like full strength with painkillers to keep them that way for a while, and they have no worries about mortality to hold them back. It's delicious, isn't it?"
Tawaller tried to suppress a shudder and did not entirely succeed. "Delicious," he repeated.
The woman shut the airlock, then held up a datapad and moved to stand at the head of the column of armored soldiers. "I'm transmitting the station plans and the locations of your targets. This information should be appearing in the heads-up displays of your helmet visors." Tawaller saw dimly glowing green shapes flickering over the visors, and several of the soldiers nodded. None spoke. The woman's lean features twisted up into a smile.
"Good. Get to it."
In 2 columns, silent except for the faint creaking of their armor, the soldiers passed to either side of the woman and headed down the passageway.
"The shuttle that brought them will take you to Kuat," the woman said. "You'd better board."
Tawaller turned and slapped the control board for the airlock. He entered and peered in some confusion through the transperisteel viewport in the door on the opposite side. It showed nothing but stars.
"It's gone," he said. "The shuttle."
He heard the airlock door hiss closed behind him. The woman's voice came across the airlock speaker.
"No, it's still there. Look harder."
Tawaller did as he was told, leaning closer to the viewport. Oh yes, he'd been wrong. Through the viewport he could see the docking tube in place, the door into the belly of the shuttle invitingly open.
"You'd better hurry."
Jason awoke from fitful sleep. The compartment he and Ben had been assigned, one of several chambers arranged around a central living area that offered access to the main passageway, had 2 beds and its own refresher, quite comfortable by the standards of traveling Jedi. It was dark, the only illumination coming from a dim glow panel above the door to the living room. Something was not wrong, but different. He glanced around, saw only the inert shape of Ben in his bed, and the rectangular openings into the refresher in the closet. Jason sat up into a cross-legged posture and closed his eyes, sinking effortlessly into a contemplative state. He looked for treachery, hatred, anger. He could feel little twinges of them, but no more than would be expected at any political gathering. Satisfied, he lay down again. A handful of meters away, in a chamber on the other side of the same living room, Luke Skywalker also sat up. Beside him, Mara opened an eye and offered him a lazy smile.
Nerves?
Luke shook his head. He turned his head back and forth, but his gaze was unfocused. Something's going on. Mara stretched and opened the other eye, giving her husband an exasperated look.
You think I couldn't sense an attack or danger?
I think that looking for an attack or danger is a mistake. Mara cast the blanket aside and stood, now suspicious and alert.
I still don't feel any aggression.
Not aggression. Fatalism.
Disease.
Luke threw up his left hand toward the door as if to ward off an attack. With a boom that shook the floor and the walls and deafened Mara momentarily, the chamber door blew off its tracks and hurtled toward Luke. Still in mid-gesture, Luke grimaced and the door instantly reversed direction, slamming back through the portal it had covered and crashing to the floor of the central living chamber beyond. Luke leapt toward the doorway, gesturing with his other hand. From the nightstand beside the bed, his lightsaber flew into his grasp, and he thumbed it into life, its snap hiss only faintly audible to his concussed ears before he landed outside the doorway. Ahead of him was the metal door. It was on the floor, warped to conform roughly to the shape of a large humanoid form, the man who triggered the explosion. The circular room was thick with doors. Three more of them, like his, were off their tracks and smoking. To his left were black armored figures, two pairs, one pair at each of the two destroyed doorways that faced each other. Smoke curled from the barrels of their oversized rifles. To his immediate right was an armored figure within reach, swinging her rifle to bear on him. And farther down, another pair of armored figures stood in front of another ruined doorway. The attackers were moving into the doorways. Ignoring the rifle woman next to him, Luke gestured right and left, and expulsions of force power swept the armored figures in both directions off their feet, hammered them into door jams, caused them to drop their weapons. Simultaneously, he twisted, bringing the center of his body out of line of the rifle woman's barrel. She fired. The shot should have passed harmlessly behind Luke's back, but it was not a blaster shot. Something shiny and thread-like expanded from the barrel. It settled across Luke, as unavoidable as a sudden forest fog, and tightened across his head, arms, legs. It was a silvery net, contracting as it touched its target. He heard it crackle as it wrapped across the blade of his lightsaber, saw it blacken where it touched the green energy blade. In a moment, he knew he'd be able to use his force skills to wrench the net off him. He didn't have a moment. As the net clamped his arms to his sides and drew his legs together in an awkward, unbalanced pose, he saw the rifleman twist a dial on the rifle's barrel. The interior of the barrel glowed. Mara's blue lightsaber blade, flashing out from the doorway, cut up through the barrel at an angle and continued across the attacker's neck. The front half of the rifle and the woman's hand fell away. Then her head rolled off, smoking at the point of the lightsaber contact, to topple to the floor. Down the curved wall to Luke's left, armored invaders who'd been preparing to enter the next chamber down turned to fire on him and Mara. One had a weapon like the rifle woman's, another carried a bigger, shoulder-mounted device. Luke turned left, rotating on the ball of one foot. He dropped his lightsaber and gestured with the hand that had held it. Ahead of him, the ceiling, a cool blue sound-insulating foam over metal, buckled and tore free, slamming down across those invaders. The attackers must have fired. In an instant, the ruined ceiling began to superheat from the blasts, the insulation on the far side bursting into flame and sending sheets of smoke up into the air. Jason had barely closed his eyes again when his compartment door blasted inward. The shock of the concussion startled him, delaying him a deadly half-second. But as he rose, as he gestured for his lightsaber, as the long barrel of the first intruder's black rifle entered and swung toward him, the attacker was suddenly bowled off his feet. Jason felt the pulse and the force that did it, felt the characteristic traits of Luke's exertion within it. Lightsaber in hand, Jason snapped it on, took a fraction of a second to wave at Ben's bed and flip it over, sending the boy into the wall and covering him with the bed. Only then did Jason leap out into the central chamber. Before him was the attacker who just tried to enter his room. To his left was another black-armored figure bringing his weapons to bear on Mara, who advanced toward them clad in black sleepwear. So we